This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi te motu, MPR.
Listening to live and on-demand shows has never been easier on MPR. All you have to do is go to the App Store or Play Store on your device and search up Access Internet Radio NZ. Select and download the first option at the top of the list. Once you've downloaded the app, the next step is to open the app and look for MPR. Once found, select it and then browse freely. Supported by New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future.
Today we have with us
Rayleigh Murphy
and Don Esselman.
And I'm Stuart Burks. Okay, now Rayleigh, you were going to tell us about your adult life when you started work at about what age?
15, and I got a job in a bank in Dunedin. Unfortunately, because I can't stand too long and I have restrictions on my body, there were certain things in the bank I couldn't do, and I was very well cared for by the bank manager, who would take me off that job and put me on to something else so that I didn't have to do too much twisting.
Okay, so was your employment a special scheme, or you just
no,
yes, you could,
a special okay. privilege, I would say. My father knew the bank manager, and so that he arranged to literally take care of me.
Okay. So do you want to say briefly just what it was, the special condition?
Well, mainly not too much standing, okay. And twisting on using a bookkeeping machine was very uncomfortable. And so he would then find a job where I could sit pretty well straight and do that work, like checking signatures and all that. All that sort of thing that was done before technology okay. came in.
So you'd had a normal schooling until then?
I did.
Okay.
And I went to Otago Girls High, and I found it very hard getting up the hill, having to walk up the hill, and especially if in the winter we'd get the bus. But okay. I didn't like high school at all. And I think because I sort of cut short and left school at 15, I got my job in the bank. So I worked there, and I was very diligent, and I was given a couple of hours off 3 days a week to go down to the hospital for exercises to try and keep the body functioning because of the polio damage.
Okay, so you got polio at what age?
7 years.
7 years
yeah.
old.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
yep.
I mean, I thought I was going to get lots of privileges, you know, if I fall over or that. But my parents very clearly said, don't expect any privileges. You're just like everybody else, get on with life.
Yeah.
And so, which developed in me a very pig-headed stubbornness that I still have this day, just to keep myself functioning. Wanting to be normal.
Now,
like
I've heard that
else.
All, what do you say, polio survivors, people who've had polio, they're all very stubborn, apparently.
Yes, it's a type, yeah. personality type.
Okay.
I've learnt that over the years, and I've been very involved in the support group of people that have had polio.
Okay.
But I managed to carry on my job, and then I had my children. I had 3 children.
Was that were there any difficulties?
No. My mother apparently was told by the doctor, don't let her have children because of the strain it puts on a woman's body. But she never did tell me, and it's just as well, because I would have gone ahead anyway. Mm. And for me right now, it's much better to have had the children and been as normal as possible and put up with any damage that it did to the body.
Yeah.
And who knows? I've got plenty of polio friends that obeyed the rules, and they're no better off than me now. So for that, I'm very grateful to have my family, and no difficulties whatsoever.
So were you one of many people with you've not said what time period this was. It was 1950s?
1948 I had it. And there was a huge epidemic from about, I think, 47 to 52.
Okay.
And the hospitals were run off their feet because the children were coming in, and I record when I went in, parked in a corridor until they found a bed. And there was nurses rushing everywhere, but it was frightening, and you just can't do anything about it. And I was in hospital 3.5 months, and they let me go home because I was fretting so badly, chewing the inside of my cheeks raw, and just crying very quietly under the blankets. And there was a little fella in the bed opposite, and his name was Leo. Don't know what other name. And he wasn't very mobile, because he would pull faces and try and make me laugh and stop crying. And anyway, then all of a sudden he disappeared, and I didn't learn until many months or maybe years later. My father knew his sister, and I said to my dad, I don't know what happened to Leo. And he said, oh, he died. And I couldn't believe it. I didn't see him go anywhere, but, I mean, he might have gone on to another ward or whatever. So it was a very frightening time.
Were you isolated? Could your family come and see
you? No. We were isolated, 6 weeks in isolation, and they were allowed to come in and look through a little glass window that had net curtains on it, so that they could look in and I couldn't see out. And I don't know how often they came, I wouldn't know, but I didn't see them, and I thought they couldn't find me. And as a 7-year-old who was so clingy, it was very devastating. And anyway, after I was coming out of isolation, they let you run for 6 weeks to see what's happened, whether you've died or hello. You go into the other open ward now, and they let my parents know, she'll be going to the open ward today. And so they were in the corridor to meet me, and so that was a lovely time. But I think I had I must have had about another 2 months in hospital with them visiting, but I still was fretting for home. And so they said, let her go home. Just let her go home. She's fretting. So I went home with crutches, and I thought I was as good as gold. But in hindsight, I can remember that's when my father bought a car, because they couldn't get me on and off buses. But other than that, I've done most things that within my range. I mean, I've decided not to try climbing Mount Everest or going for a marathon run, but I can do certain things, and I like doing them, and I'll give anything a go.
So you were able then just to go back to school and...
I was off school for a long time, and also too, when I was at school, I was only allowed to go in the mornings, and every afternoon I had to rest. And I didn't want to rest because I'd been in bed, and you die when you're in bed. But the headmaster of the school decided to let me have all the new library books before they'd gone out into the library, to try and coax me to get it stay in bed. And I mean, that was another very good privilege. And so that was what happened. But in hindsight, I can see I missed a lot of the schooling through that. So apart from that, I was able to do what I wanted. And then many years later, when I was in my early 40s, I had a very good friend who was a trained teacher. And she was a couple of years older than me, maybe 20 years older, because she's gone now. But she said to me, "Oh, Rayleigh, you're a bother," she said. "You're an underachiever." And I go, "Oh." And she said, "Why don't you go and do something out at Massey?" And I go, "Oh, no." And she said, well, you think about it. So I went away home and I thought about it. And the next morning I rang her and I said, were you for sure? Yeah. So we went and worked it out what sort of paper I could do. And she didn't say to me that it takes hours and hours for one paper. And I went out to Massey and we worked out what I was going to do. And the little lady, I can't remember her name now, but was doing the enroller. When she asked me a question, my friend answered for me. And then the little lady asked me another question. And I answered that one. And then she asked me another question. And I was sort of thinking, and my friend answered yet again. And then the little lady said to my friend, don't you think she should go to Polytech? And she said, no, she wants to go to Massey. And so I came out enrolled for two papers.
Okay.
And my friend nearly had a pink fit because she said, if you knew, I didn't even know how to write an assignment.
Mm.
And she said, if you knew how much time each paper takes.
Mm.
But I soldiered on and I got all five papers, just 100 level. And I had to work hard at getting there. My first paper, I went right off the track. And the first assignment I got, and the professor was saying, nobody got 10, few got 9, lots got 8, lots got whatever, 7. And this person that got 2, and I looked at him, and I sort of didn't flinch, and he said, never mind, Winston Churchill didn't do very well at university, but look where he got. And so I thought, oh, couldn't wait to get home to tell my friend, Millie.
Mm.
And I rang her and I said, I got my assignment. What'd you get for it? 2.
Mm.
What? Don't tell anyone. And I thought, I couldn't make that up for the other assignment. So I did that paper again next year. Unfortunately, they changed all the textbooks. But anyway, I did get it the next time, and so out of all my effort, I got a rehab certificate.
Good.
And so that made...
Because, of course, a lot of it is a matter of learning the study skills,
absolutely,
what's required.
Absolutely. But I didn't do any of that.
Yeah.
I was going to tell them what they've got wrong. And it was very interesting.
Because you were stubborn because of the polio.
Yes. But I thought I knew it all. Mm. And because I did have that behind me, I thought I'd like to apply for a job. This was many moons later, and there was an advertisement in the paper for a manager for the victim support group.
Now let's get the timing. You left school at 15, you worked in a bank for...
Six years.
Yep. And then what? You married and had children, or you kept working in another job?
No. I literally did bits and pieces at home. My father was an accountant, so he would bring me a lot of work, and I would code his accounts. I'd go through someone's checkbook, and I'd write, "Oh, that was for repairs, maintenance. This for drawing." And so I did that. I've never really been not doing anything.
Okay.
So
were you married then, or
Okay. Married at 19, and then divorced about 40-something.
Okay.
And it was after the divorce that I decided, to study.
Okay. Children were just about grown up?
Yes, they're all... I had to wait until I knew that they could support themselves because there's no show that I could have.
Yes.
And so that's why that timing was like that.
Yeah. Okay. So you divorced, you started study, you got your certificate, and then?
At the victim support.
Okay.
And I went for the interview, and it was a voluntary job, but I went for the interview with my certificate and a couple of references from people that I had gathered up from people. And so by going, I mean, it was a bit of an overkill for a voluntary job, but they asked me if I'd like to do the job, would I go back and talk to them? And I was in two minds because I thought, I don't even know if I can be bothered getting all cleaned up for an hour a day. But I did do it, and I decided that I would take it on. And I did say to them, I can do anything, but you're no good making me rush. Well, it's a wonder they didn't show me the door, but they didn't. And so they decided, look, you try it and see how it is. And
so how were you sort of mobility-wise?
I was walking without a walker or anything. I was still managing to walk without.
Okay.
It's when I started to need my walker, that's when I thought I needed to come away. And so 14 years I did that.
So what were you, and was that a part-time voluntary work?
It was voluntary, but after about maybe 15 months, they started paying me. And then because the way the groups are structured, I was there to get all the work off the cops, and I had four teams of people, 16 workers in all. And this week they're on, and so they would go out. I would go and get the jobs, and then I'd refer them to the workers. And they would, and of course, once I'd done all that, I came home. They knew I was here, and they have to let me know when they get home and make sure everything's okay.
So, was this the early days of victim support?
Yes.
When did it start up? Do you know?
1992.
Okay.
Yeah, and I was doing that until 2004.
Okay.
Just after the flood here.
Okay.
So I enjoyed that, and I had a lot of lovely privileges by being with them, because they'd have lovely seminars. And I got to go to Invercargill, Waitangi, Mount Cook. They were all paid. I was still mobile enough to be able to do it.
Okay.
But it was getting hard if I had a bedroom way down the end of a corridor somewhere.
So did victim support change much in your time?
Yes.
So it started off as
me and trying to get together with a couple of other coordinators, and then it developed like a lot of things, and they had a CEO.
Yeah. How did it actually start off, do you know?
It started off after the Bola storm up in Gisborne.
Okay.
And it started up there, and then it slowly merged at different places.
Yeah.
And when I first started, there was no central office. So we had the other coordinators and myself. Yeah. We had to get together and try and get a plan together so that your group is working like this group, and hello, they've got some good ideas, and hello, you have too. So we all we made it work, and then all of a sudden, once there was all the superstructure, they started saying, when we got any money or whatever, and head office wants it, like a lot of things went like that. And so and then they decided that we don't want to fit our victim support group in Fielding. We want to merge all of Fielding workers with Palmerston North. And my workers said they're not interested.
And they were all voluntary workers?
Yes.
And how much time would a volunteer put in?
Well, the volunteers were on one week on, 7 days a week, and somebody had the pager. It was a pager, no cell phones or anything. The cell phone was a brick, and that was really troublesome, because somebody one time turned it upside down and put it on the cradle, and of course it got to the next worker, and it's no charge in it. They didn't know. And so, sometimes they had a lot of work, and sometimes they didn't. And I think there was a couple of murders. There was one out at Sanson. And that's where victim support has gone much more. Not so much worried about the little old lady's letterbox that got kicked in. They don't worry about that now, which is okay. But they're going more into, like, the massacre down in Christchurch.
So people need a lot more specialist training now and counselling support afterwards and so on?
Yes, that was my job, to make sure nobody started to fall over.
Okay.
Yeah, and then I would counsel them to a degree, but then I would get outside help for them if they needed it, because I've only got just to my own level. And so, I think they're very well looked after, mine were. And I think all of them would be, because it's very tough on the emotions.
Yeah. So where do the volunteers come from? Are they just
We advertised, and there was myself, the chairman, and someone from the committee, and we would interview them. We asked the questions. We had set questions to ask them, and we sort of had to try get to know them face to face. And when somebody came in and she was being interviewed, she was wiping her nose all the time and all sorts. So we thought, you know, come on, we've got to have a certain standard. And so there was lots of reasons why we chose people. Some of them had a good idea. Some of them wanted to change the world. But, you know, for victim support, you've got to have good ears. And you've got to listen properly and not form any opinions. Because I didn't go into any of the places, but they would tell me, oh, gosh, you would die. And then, of course, we had somebody hit by a train. And I forget who did that job, but that was really bad. And the police told the workers they need to have a packet of peppermints in their pocket so that they... Because and they went down to the supermarket and got plastic bags to put, and you know, it was really
So what were the peppermints for?
To get rid of the odours.
Oh, okay.
I didn't know that, but the workers told me, and I thought, yeah, that makes sense. But I had a lovely group of workers, and as I say, I've been away from there for ages now. There's several still keep in touch with me, and there's two of them very sick, and I thought, oh, one of them could help me drive to somewhere, but she doesn't drive, and the other one's got Alzheimer's. That's really sad. So I just keep in phone touch with them. I can't get into their houses, so I keep in touch with them by phone, and I find that's quite good. I mean, I'm happy to do it because I can sit comfortably in my chair.
On victim support, how were they funded though? Is it totally voluntary, or they get government support? Or
they did get some. Well, they didn't need a lot, but they needed for my wages.
Okay.
The police gave us a room in the station, and they let us use their photocopier and their shredder machine and any papers we wanted. They were very good. When I first went into the station, I wondered how they would cope with this little grey-haired lady that maybe wears a twin set from time to time with pearls around her neck. And they're very interesting because they're such a tight-knit group of people. I was like a flea in the ointment. And if I'd walk into a room, everyone would shut up. And so I didn't stay too long in the room. I go back to my own little office. But I gradually they got used to me. I mean, they didn't discuss all sorts of things with me, and I didn't want to. I mean, you get there one day and somebody's got a black eye and somebody else is limping. They've been caught up in something that's been going on. And, I mean, if I asked, they'd tell me, but I didn't really care. That was their thing. I've got the other side. So that was an interesting time for me.
So you found the police sort of socially quite different from other people?
Yes.
Okay.
They're a very tight-knit lot. Great support for each other. I was also in the station working when Duncan Taylor was shot. And that day I had gone down to Carterton to find out if my car could be modified to have my wheelchair in it. And I didn't know that anything had happened, but one of my workers had been notified, and the police said, no, we don't want victim support. Because they've got their own support network from head office.
So you say Duncan Taylor was shot.
Duncan Taylor was the traffic cop, and Jeanette was the one with him. And they went just out a little bit towards Rangatira, and there was a young guy shot at them. And he shot Duncan, and he was killed. And he was after Jeanette, and she got a shot in the leg. Broke her shoe as she's flying across the paddock somewhere. And of course, when I got home, one of the workers rang me and she said, I think it might pay you to get round to the station. I'd finished for the day. And strangely enough, Duncan had been here with a couple of other cops lifting my wheelchair into the car because I didn't have a hoist or anything. And I went round to the station and, gosh, I've never seen anything like it. The cops were so shattered. The door was shut there and someone's crying behind that door. And, oh, honestly, it was... And I didn't need to be there. In fact, I was in the way. And they certainly were looked after by their own hierarchy. And they had a meal room out the back. And a lot of them were out there where they could make a cup of tea. And the whoever was from Wellington, I can't remember who he was now, but he ordered in pizzas and that and food for them. Just anything to try and help them to cope. But, yeah, it was a very interesting time.
Okay. And then you moved on from victim support, did you?
I did move on from victim support, and I gave up, and I thought, what am I going to do now?
What made you give up? You just thought you'd had enough of it?
I was starting to need too much help.
Ah, for your mobility.
And I didn't really want to be standing by the photocopier and have some cop try and get out the back door and fall over my wheels.
Okay. When you say your wheels, it's
these.
Which wheels? What would you call that?
It's a stroller.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of four wheels and two handles and a brake and a seat you can sit on.
And I had a funny little office at the police station. It was like a broom cupboard, and I don't think I could have got my wheels into there. But no, I thought that was about time that I gave it away, and it was only a short time later when they shut down the victim support in Fielding.
Okay.
So, but I enjoyed doing that. I just did.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
Support this program and others like it by giving a donation to NPR. More details at npr.nz.